Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama addressed an enormous crowd in Berlin. This is his first stop in Europe after visits this week to Afghanistan, Iraq, Jordan, and Israel. Obama spoke to a crowd of Berliners and American expatriates, many of them waving American flags, from a park not far from where the Berlin Wall once divided the city. In his speech, he recalled the post-war period of German-American reconciliation and the rebuilding of Europe, and he urged Americans and Europeans to work together again to defeat terror and to counter the religious extremism that supported it.
Yes, there have been differences between America and Europe. No doubt there will be differences in the future. But the burdens of global citizenship continue to bind us together. A change of leadership in Washington will not lift this burden. In this new century, Americans and Europeans alike will be required to do more, not less. Partnership and cooperation among nations is not a choice. It is the only way, the one way, to protect our common security and advance our common humanity. That is why the greatest danger of all is to allow new walls to divide us from one another. The walls between old allies on either side of the Atlantic cannot stand. The walls between the countries with the most and those with the least cannot stand. The walls between races and tribes, natives and immigrants, Christians and Muslims and Jews cannot stand. These now are the walls we must tear down.
Senator Barack Obama speaking just moments ago in Berlin. The speech, even before it was delivered, was hyped, even compared to appearances in Berlin by American Presidents Kennedy and Reagan. Never mind that Obama is still only a candidate for president. So what is it about Germany and U.S. presidents, or in this case, U.S. presidential candidates? Earlier today, I spoke with Malte Lemming of the Berlin newspaper Der Tagesspiegel. Why so much excitement about Obama in Germany?
First of all, the obvious. He is young, good-looking, smart, charming, charismatic. And how many German politicians do you know who have these, who meet these criteria? The German politician's lack of charisma is just striking. So there is a need. He fills a void for a charismatic politician. But that's just a part of the answer.
What's the other part of the answer?
The Germans are flattered. They feel very proud that Barack Obama were chosen Berlin, the capital of Germany, for his only major speech in Europe. So they feel, okay, after 8 years that the Bush administration left us aside because we were not participating in the Iraq war and things like that, finally there is somebody who values us as the, let's say, most important continental European country.
Tell us, Malte, about the venue. I understand he's speaking at the Victory Column in Berlin, but at first his campaign wanted him to speak at the Brandenburg Gate, which, of course, a very symbolic Cold War site where Presidents Kennedy and Reagan made famous speeches. And here in the U.S., some critics have suggested that this was somewhat presumptuous of a candidate for president to ask to speak there. And I gather Chancellor Merkel opposed the site as well.
Yes, Angela Merkel opposed the site as well. And, I mean, the impression is right now in Germany, some people might have been asleep for a couple of days and just woke up because many Germans think that here the president comes to Berlin. And it seems that Angela Merkel realized, as the very few politicians, that he is not even the candidate. He is the designated candidate from the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So many people thought, if Barack Obama comes, he for sure will be the next president, so give him the Brandenburg Gate. And she was more or less the only one, but the chancellor, who didn't allow him to.
Now, we mentioned that Obama met with the chancellor earlier today. Your chancellor is known as being something of an ally with President Bush. Any idea what they discussed, how that meeting went, what the chemistry was like between them?
I'm pretty sure the chemistry was good, because I can't think about a politician who has not build up a good chemistry with Angela Merkel. She is just good with people. Germans themselves see in Barack Obama something like a partner who promotes world peace and understanding in the world and who fights global warming and things like this. So after he met with our foreign minister, Steinmeier, he actually said that we are of the same mind. We prefer cooperation instead of confrontation.
Now, he's coming to Europe after touring the Middle East. He was in Iraq, Afghanistan, Jordan, Israel. One of the policy changes that he's been talking about is moving more troops, U.S. and allied, to Afghanistan from Iraq. Do you expect him to take up that idea in his speech today? And how will that sit with Germans?
Definitely, he will ask Germans to contribute more and more troops to the Afghanistan battle. This is very unpopular in Germany. Most Germans, according to polls, prefer to pull out all the troops of Afghanistan, and very, very few politicians would be willing to send in more troops.
Well, we've been talking about Obama, of course, and almost this rock star quality that he seems to possess over there. What about Senator John McCain? Do Germans know him? Are there, you know, is there widespread interest in this contest?
Not at all. I mean, the political class knows him very well because he's a frequent traveler to Germany. He participated in a number of conferences, security conferences in Munich. So I think the political class knows John McCain, Senator McCain, very, very well. But the Germans themselves, the society, has, I would say, a more or less negative image of John McCain. They see in him like he would pursue a more Bush-like policy, which was very unpopular in Germany.
Finally, give me a sense of how your paper is following this election. How much will you be covering it, and what are the big issues that you're interested in?
Tomorrow's edition, for sure, is the front page, the second, third page, and the whole local edition for the Obama visit in Berlin. But in general, we are following it very, very closely. And it was quite exciting. I mean, the duel between Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton was exciting as well, because everybody thought until January or February that Clinton looks like the natural-born winner of this duel. And it was got all very exciting. And this is part of the charisma Barack Obama has, because who is he that he, coming from nowhere, were beating Hillary Clinton? So Germans are quite curious to see him, to listen to him, and to hear him speak.
That's Malte Lemming of the newspaper Der Tagesspiegel talking to us from Berlin. We turn now to John Harwood, political writer for the New York Times and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. And John, you wrote earlier this week that it might not really matter what Obama says in Germany. The real front in this election is in places like Michigan and Ohio, where John McCain is campaigning today.
Well, I mean, Americans all of a sudden are very shaken up about their economic futures. When this campaign started in late 2006, early 2007, the violence in Iraq had reached such a crescendo that people assumed that Iraq was going to be the dominant issue in 08, as it was in the 06 election when Democrats won back power. But since then, the housing crisis, the financial market crisis have created so much more fear than existed before. Americans have seen big institutions on Wall Street seem to teeter on the verge of falling over. We now have Congress moving on a big housing bill to try to keep some people in their homes and prop up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these big giant mortgage companies. So that palpable fear by Americans has really displaced in all the polls the concern about Iraq. So, yes, Barack Obama is getting tremendous publicity and headlines this week, but it's just one week in the campaign. John McCain's still in the game, and ultimately the swing voters in battleground states are likely to make up their minds on who they trust more to do something to turn around this economy.
I want to talk about that issue of trust, but first, before we leave this phenomenon of Obama in Berlin, could this foreign trip even backfire because of this? That is, especially swing voters concerned about the economy, seeing these images of adoring throngs 3,000 miles away, could that somehow even hurt him?
I doubt it. I wouldn't think that that would really come back to bite him. Barack Obama's got multiple goals in the campaign, and one of them is to try to achieve minimum credibility as a potential leader of the United States, commander-in-chief. That's his burden, this trip can help him advance that. But he's going to come back. This is just one week in the campaign. He's going to come back and focus on the economy as well. So I think he gets that, too. It's just that unlike John McCain, who people already presume to be an acceptable commander-in-chief. Barack Obama has to establish that.
Mm. You also wrote this week that you pointed to polls that suggest that Senator Obama hasn't yet cemented advantages, either in convincing voters that he has the experience or that he has the right policy prescriptions for what ails the country, the issues that you were just talking about before.
Well, it's interesting. All of the circumstantial factors would seem to favor Barack Obama. That is to say, economic slowdown and anxiety on the watch of a Republican president would naturally make that argument fall toward the Democrat running to succeed him. However, Barack Obama is new to the stage. A lot of people, and when you talk to his own campaign strategist privately, will say, we haven't yet made plain enough to people exactly how we would change economic policies of the United States. He does have a plan to raise taxes on people at the high end, cut them for people at the low end, invest more in alternative energy, have a more aggressive government role. But he's got to make sure people understand what that means, what it would mean to them. And he also has to make them feel safe about him as a potential leader of the country. Part of that's national security, but it's also part of the economy. John McCain is the familiar figure. And I talked to a pollster in Michigan who said John McCain has the trust right now because people, even if they're unhappy with George Bush, John McCain's a known quantity. Barack Obama's still unknown.
You know, that's an interesting point. I was looking at a poll today in the Wall Street Journal, a Wall Street Journal NBC poll out today, which shows Obama with a leading McCain nationally by a few percentage points, but that more voters identify with McCain's background and values than Obama's. That seems like a contradiction to me. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's partly the fact, the racial factor. We have not seen, we've had 200 years of white guy candidates for president, and we've had exactly one African-American nominee for a major party. And it's a 46-year-old guy who's only been in Washington for 4 years. So he's got to make people more comfortable with him culturally and as a matter of policy. And that's one of the challenges facing him. But, boy, we can see from the kind of publicity he's getting this week and the breaks that he's gotten in foreign policy with the Maliki government embracing his prescription for Iraq, that so many things are going in his favor right now. John McCain's trying to buck a pretty strong tide.
Hmm. So how does John McCain emerge from this week? You make the point that this is just 1 week in the campaign. But, you know, give me your sense about how John McCain emerges from this week with these huge pictures sort of splashed across newspapers and TV screens of Obama on his sort of foreign travels.
Well, a couple things he's hoping for. First of all, he's tried to break through somewhat by attacking Obama, by sort of putting out zingers before and after Obama speaks overseas. There was this diversion put out that you saw a couple of days ago. Bob Novak, the columnist, put something on the website saying, oh, maybe John McCain will announce his vice president this week. That created a stir of attention. He's also trying to get local coverage in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania to convince people, I want to do something, especially on energy and gas prices. Barack Obama is against the steps like oil drilling that I'm prepared to take.
Mm. Well, John Harwood, thanks so much for helping us out today. It was good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
That's John Harwood, political writer for The New York Times and CNBC chief Washington correspondent. For many Americans, the war in Iraq is a distant phenomenon, largely out of sight and out of mind. But for Brian and Alma Hart of Bedford, Massachusetts, the war hits home every day. Their son, Army Private First Class John Hart, was killed in action in 2003, and the Harts have turned their loss into a mission. They are outspoken advocates for better body armor and more medical supplies for the soldiers and Marines deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here and Now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff reports.
The Harts' home in Bedford has an American flag hanging outside with a Gold Star banner. It signifies their son died in service to his country. In their living room, Alma Hart has devoted the bay window to him, Army Private First Class John Hart.
Here's his medals. That's the Bronze Star for bravery, and this is his Purple Heart.
Brian Hart this says 20-year-old John was killed in Iraq while on patrol in an unarmored Humvee in October 2003.
They were trying to find insurgents that had been firing rockets at a base, and the insurgents found them.
Anyone who's lost a loved one will say it forever changes their lives. But in the case of the Harts, everything about their mission and purpose has changed. It started a week before their son was killed. John called home from Iraq and asked his father for help to get more body armor and armor for the Humvees he was driving in. His mother, Alma, remembers the call well.
As soon as Brian hung up, he told me what John had said, and he's pacing back and forth across the living room on who should we contact, what can we do that won't have any feedback on John, how do we do this without getting John in trouble. A week later, John was dead, and it was like, okay, well, we can do anything we need to do now. They can't hurt us any more than this.
Around this time, then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told a group of soldiers who were complaining they had insufficient protection that the Army was producing extra armor for Humvees as fast as possible. Brian Hart didn't accept that explanation. He researched the vehicle's production, called the plant, and spoke with workers who said they were sitting idle.
Come to find out, the plant had not received the purchase orders. And that was when I made a determination with Alma that I would resign from my job and become an advocate for equipment for soldiers for what we thought would be a few months. I mean, we thought it was a miscommunication, a misunderstanding, and of course it turned out it wasn't.
Hart didn't give up after a few months. He spent almost 5 years calling for better equipment for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Hart has worked with powerful allies, including Senator Ted Kennedy. At his son's funeral, he asked the senator why a third of the troops didn't have body armor and why there were only 440 armored Humvees in Iraq. Kennedy held a congressional hearing. 6 months later, all troops had body armor, and in about 2 years, there were almost 20,000 armored Humvees in Iraq, and the Hart family found a new calling.
It was sort of baffling. I mean, we built pharmacy automation equipment. We had no experience in these matters. But John, as a 20-year-old, believed that you can make a difference as a person. And he and the other soldiers that enlisted with him felt that way. You know, we believe that ordinary people can make a difference and that we have an obligation to the country and in particular to the soldiers we sent to war.
More than 4,100 U.S. soldiers have been killed in this war, but only a handful of their relatives have taken on advocacy like the Harts. Roger Charles, a retired Marine colonel now with the advocacy group Soldiers for the Truth, worked with the Harts on increasing the production of armored Humvees.
Brian and Alma were really the catalyst, and by getting connected with Senator Kennedy and by his making the kind of commitment he made, we're able, I think, to make a real difference, and people's lives were saved.
Hart works on issues by thoroughly researching them and posting what he finds on his blog. Then active duty soldiers and National Guard families call him, and he encourages them to contact Congress. The Harts have influenced, in some small part, billions of dollars of defense spending, but they have never received money for their work and haven't set up a nonprofit to raise funds. They've been living off their savings and are propelled by the calls and notes of thanks that come from soldiers and their families. Alma picks up a photo in their living room of a soldier in Iraq kneeling in front of a blown-up Humvee, holding a handwritten sign. Here's what it says.
Thanks to Brian and Alma Hart and Senator Kennedy and everyone who cares for our well-being and makes an effort. You have saved lives.
After bringing the public's attention to unarmored Humvees, Hart worked on getting armor for trucks driven by National Guard soldiers. Then he learned the Army lacked infield tourniquets. Hart says the Army's own study showed that 15% of casualties could have been saved by issuing single-handed tourniquets and blood-clotting agents. Following his advocacy, the Army started issuing them to every soldier in 2006. Now Brian Hart is focusing on getting Congress to investigate why the Marines are canceling orders for mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles, or MRAPs. They're armored fighting vehicles designed to resist IEDs and ambushes. Defense Secretary Robert Gates credits them with saving lives and has made them a top priority. The Army has ordered 12,000, but Hart says the Marines scaled back their order by 9%, which Hart says is indicative of the backward thinking in the military.
Believe it or not, the Marines have canceled their orders for MRAPs, claim they're too heavy for an amphibious assault operation, as if we were going to somehow invade Iwo Jima again. I mean, the reality of the war is that Marines and soldiers need MRAPs to survive.
The Marines say they reduced their order because of the improving security situation in Iraq. Recently, Brian Hart, the advocate, got his first defense contract. He and his brother started a company in 2005 building robots to dismantle car bombs and IEDs. In June, they received $800,000 from the Pentagon. But Hart says his commercial venture won't keep him quiet on troop safety issues.
There's a point where you realize that you have nothing to lose and that you can't live in fear if you want to live in freedom. And having the courage to act is probably the one thing the dead can't do. And it is our obligation to the soldiers we send to war to advocate for them as a citizen in this country.
And that's Brian Hart of Bedford, Massachusetts, ending that report by Monica Brady Meyerhoff. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now.
But consensus on global warming. Is there one or is there not?
Environmental implications of everything that you buy and everything.
It is, in fact.
Okay, we're going to spend a few minutes now talking about, that's right, global warming. But this won't be your usual discussion about what many call the most pressing problem facing humanity.
We feel very, very passionate about global warming and we're very, very upset about it.
Yeah.
We just don't know why we're upset.
What? How can you be upset and not know why?
Yeah, I've been upset and not know why many times.
Yeah.
Most mornings I'm upset and I don't know why.
It's true.
That's a scene from a new film by Randy Olson. Olson is a Harvard-trained marine biologist turned movie maker. You might remember his critically acclaimed Flock of Dodos, a mockumentary that poked fun at both sides of the evolution-intelligent design debate. Olson has taken a similar tack with his new film Sizzle, a global warming comedy. And he joins us now from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. And Randy Olson, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So tell me, why another film about global warming? And why a comedy about global warming? I mean, this is serious business, obviously. But why did you want to make a comedy to talk about global warming?
Because humor and sincerity and emotion have the ability to reach broader audiences. This movie is, to some extent, the same basic elements as the Al Gore movie, which I thought was excellent. But his movie had a lot of information and a little bit of humor. You know, they worked with him to try and lighten him up a little bit and tell a few jokes. With this movie, I've used the same basic elements, just kind of reapportioned their amounts and tried to pull back on the information and instead develop the humor much more and also the sincerity when we go to New Orleans to see the results of Hurricane Katrina 2 years down the line.
Right. And that's where sort of the movie ends up. But let's talk about some of your characters because they sort of set up a lot of the humors in this movie. Your producers are two obviously well-off, obviously gay men named Brian and Mitch. They believe in your film, but they don't think that you are necessarily the most effective person to tell the story. And they want to get a celebrity to host the film. And I want to play a clip from that. Let's listen.
All right, so we're going to need to interview some people, and I've got a list here of some of the people I think that we ought to interview.
Oh,
to
great
to
minds. We
the
did
movie.
The same
we
thing
made a list also.
Over brioche.
All right, so what I'm thinking are some of the world's top global warming experts, which, you know, actually there's a number of them here in Southern California.
Us too, yep.
So first choice is Dr. Richard Somerville at Scripps Institute of Oceanography.
Well, our first one is actually Tom Cruise.
Right.
It would be fantastic.
Tom Cruise is not a scientist.
Well, he's a Scientologist. So a lot of people don't know the difference.
I would love to get Kate Winslet because I actually saw her on Inside the Actors Studio and she comes off as really legitimate and very British and I think that would add a lot of authority.
Yeah.
She would add a lot of authority because she's got that British accent.
And people respond to that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I can ask this with a straight face, but it occurred to me as I watched it, it does interweave comedy that's made up with comedic actors, as well as real interviews with real global warming experts. And some of these scenes come to a great head, and I want to sort of play another clip. This is your first interview is with one of the world's leading climate scientists, and everything seems to be going well until Marion, who's your cameraman, played by comedian Alex Thomas, sort of starts interrupting the interview. And let's listen to this.
All right, let me ask you three simple little questions. Do you think the planet has warmed substantially in the past 100 years?
Yes.
Number two, do you think humans have played a major role in that warming?
Yes.
And number three, do you think humans can do something to stop it or reverse it?
Yes.
I do. Okay. Come on, man. I mean, I'm being real with you, Randy. I'm not trying to, you know, just interrupt or anything, but I think it's a scam, man.
Hold it down.
I believe it. All right, I'm sorry, Randy.
Hold it down. This is not, you're not doing this interview.
Okay, but I mean, if something, I got to be real about it, right? I think global warming may affect us 150 years from now.
Just come on.
150 years.
So talk about that scene. I mean, tell me what the point. What's the point here? Is Marion sort of standing in for your average Joe who has kind of everyday skepticism about climate change?
Yes, Marion does represent the average person, and he ended up asking very simple and broad questions. Some of them are just kind of common sense questions. How is it that if global warming is so important, we're getting things like it was snowing in South Africa at the time of the Live Aid concert that they had? And these sorts of things that people need to accept, the general public has a hard time with some of the science of global warming. And that's a lot of the voice of this movie, which is, we interviewed two of the top climate scientists, Richard Somerville and Jerry Miehl, and they're doing their best to simply take the truth and get it out there to the public. The problem that they're running into is they've got voices at each ends of the spectrum. They've got the skeptics from one direction grabbing everything they say and pulling it off to their agenda, and then the environmental groups are grabbing a lot of the stuff and exaggerating at times and saying that this is possibly the end of the world. And the scientists are just stuck in the middle there trying to communicate the truth to the best of their ability. That's mostly what this film is about.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to your role in the film. You play a straight man to sort of Marion and Antoine and Brian and Mitch, your crew. They make fun of you, call you uptight. You're sort of a clueless scientist. You don't really know how to communicate your message. You want to use PowerPoint in the movie. And my question is... How close is the Randy that you play in the movie to the real Randy Olson?
That's extremely important, and it's something for the science world to listen to, that I'm not play acting in the movie for the most part. That is the real me, and when those guys are making fun of me in the Senate hearing room, there was no script to that. I was not present for that scene. That's the real Randy that all my friends have constantly made fun of for 15 years in Hollywood, because despite living here for 14 years and hanging out with the hippest and the coolest of people, I still have the voice and the style and the mannerisms of a scientist, and that's the way that it goes.
Look, I'm not Randy. So
what do you say?
Let me try to do Randy. So, tell me.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I mean, Randy would be cool if he would just stop being so damn tight.
You know what I think it is?
What?
I think dude was like a buster as a kid. He's a dude, they didn't pick him up for the softball team.
Exactly.
He was a terrible athlete, so he said, let me be a scientist.
So we get the point, Randy. You're a bit of a square here. Just last month, the Senate failed to pass a bill curbing greenhouse gases that many maintain are responsible for climate change. Is this the problem? I mean, that the message just isn't getting through, that the scientists aren't getting the message through?
I think that's absolutely the problem. The polls show that the Al Gore movie put the issue of global warming on the radar screen, but it hasn't changed the overall public opinion about whether we need to act on this issue. And they've hit a brick wall with it. And, you know, I hate to say it, but to some extent, the Al Gore message has run out of gas a little bit. And there's a need to reinvent it, rework it. I think he was trying to do that last Thursday with a speech that he gave. And it's important that other people try and do that. And there is a huge disconnect because you get this malaise among the general public. And at the same time, just last month, you had James Hansen, the former head of NASA, speaking to Congress and saying that people who are working against this sort of legislation should be tried for crimes against humanity. That's a huge disconnect between the voice of the science world and the actual implementation in the political arena.
Hmm. That's Randy Olson. He's the director of Sizzle, a global warming comedy. The film has its East Coast premiere Saturday at the Woods Hole Film Festival on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. For more information about the film, go to our website, here-now.org. And Randy, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us today.
You betcha.
You're listening to Here and Now. Television's big hit of last summer wasn't a program on HBO, Showtime, or any of the other usual cable suspects. It was Mad Men, the Emmy Award-winning period piece about the advertising industry. Mad Men airs on American Movie Classics, a cable channel known more for showing first-rate movies than producing TV series. Here and Now critic-at-large Ed Siegel has seen the first episode of the new season, which airs this coming Sunday night, and he offers his take on what makes Mad Men so compelling.
Despite the nostalgic hype, the late 50s and early 60s weren't an age of innocence. Last year's Mad Men, set in 1960, reminded us of the real thing. Richard Nixon beat poetry, racism, anti-Semitism, and a booming post-war sense of prosperity and confidence.
Who could not be happy with all this?
It's the best.
Like some supersonic jet flying right over the market.
Ollie, Ollie, oxen free!
Mad Men is a play on ad men, those advertising guys in their gray flannel suits on Madison Avenue, where men are men, fueled by alcohol and nicotine, and women are their prey.
Remember, Dot, when God closes a door, he opens a dress.
Bet you wish you could pour that in a glass and drink it.
Mad Men is hardly a celebration of those sentiments, but it's not an overt condemnation of anyone or anything either, and that accounts for much of the Mad Men dramatic power. The main character, Don Draper, is capable of extraordinary strength and extraordinary weakness. He's married with children, but flits from mistress to mistress. Don Draper isn't even his real name. He put his army dog tags on a slain soldier in Korea during the war there, so his family would think he's dead, allowing him to forge a new identity. And this show is all about finding one's identity in a time of crushing conformity and ethnic and sexual stereotypes.
I'm gonna sing my song. It won't take long.
So now it's on to season two. The opening episode is called For Those Who Think Young, Pepsi-Cola's advertising slogan from the early 60s. It's 1962, in fact, and John Kennedy is in the White House after defeating Richard Nixon, whom Draper's agency backed. Here's Draper, played by the hunky John Hamm, dragging on a lucky strike and reacting to the punning slogans for a new client, Mohawk Airlines.
So it's about an airline that's flown by Indians? Maybe a plane with some arrows stuck in the cargo door? That's funny. That's what gets people's attention now, right? There has to be advertising for people who don't have a sense of humor.
I understand.
What else you got?
Hamm is the riveting star of the show, but Mad Men is really an ensemble endeavor, beautifully written by Matthew Weiner, formerly of The Sopranos. HBO turned him down for this one and has been regretting it ever since. It's not only perfectly peopled by a great cast of little-known actors, but Weiner captures the early 60s with a mixture of subtlety and style, transporting us into the soon-to-be-changing times with the jolt of an Edward Hopper painting or a Frank Sinatra album cover. The Mad Men still want to party like it's 1959, but their bodies are betraying them. After a doctor tells him he has to slow down, Draper stops in a bar where he sees a young man reading Frank O'Hara's Meditations in an Emergency, and he gets a copy for himself. But why? To find out more about himself, or to gather information for a seduction?
Now I am quietly waiting for the catastrophe of my personality to seem beautiful again, and interesting, and modern.
The other main period clip, Jackie Kennedy's tour of the White House, is used with equal effect, tying in the personal, professional, and political aspects of the show. We now know that JFK was cheating on his trophy wife, but the women in the show see Jackie O as a model for a growing sense of power over their own lives. Is playing dumb just to get ahead coming to an end? Sunday night's premiere spends a little too much time setting things up for future episodes, so if you haven't seen the first season, try to rent the DVDs. That'll give you a full taste of what makes these men and women so mad and so impossible to stop watching.
Here and Now critic-at-large Ed Siegel. The second season of Mad Men premieres Sunday night on the AMC cable channel. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, is it a Venus-Mars thing? The great debate over wine versus beer, here and now. It's one of those age-old questions that can sometimes prompt a passionate debate. Beer or wine? Marnie Old, a sommelier, argues that wine is a cornerstone of civilization, so valued that it was once used as currency in ancient Rome. Sam Calagione, a beer brewer, responds this way. Beer is more deeply embedded in human DNA, and its discovery prodded humans to leave their hunter-gathering ways behind and become settled farmers. This is part of a running dialogue that Marnie Old and Sam Calagione have in their new book called He Said Beer, She Said Wine, Impassioned Food Pairings to Debate and Enjoy from Burgers to Brie and Beyond. And Marnie Old joins us from Philadelphia and Sam Calagione from New York. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you. Let's dive into the debate. Sam, here's your chance. Why is beer better?
Well, it's a more affordable luxury, frankly. You know, you go into your local liquor store with $20 and you're sure with that money to come out with at least probably 2 6-packs of world-class beer. If you go into that store and ask for $20 worth of world-class wine, they'd have to decant it into a Dixie cup. So they've got some challenges on the high end. Also, just in terms of complexity, more ingredients leads to more complexity. Wine is just the grape, the grape, the grape. That's all it is. And beer, at the very least, is 4 ingredients, water, yeast, hops, and barley. And then if you look at modern American craft brewers, like my brewery, Dogfish Head, we use raisins, beet sugars, fruits, spices, you name it. So the complexity is truly infinite compared to wine, which relies on one ingredient.
Okay, Marnie, give us your best pitch. Why is wine better?
Well, I think Sam has actually made part of my argument for me. He's right that people are willing to pay more for wine than they are for beer. And the last time I checked, the laws of supply and demand would say that that means it's a higher quality product. But I think the other part of his statement there that beer's multiple ingredients are somehow a additional quality factor is also deeply misguided. I mean, the reality is that wine has one ingredient, grapes, because that ingredient is so perfect on its own and needs nothing else to make it taste better. Where clearly beer, we need to throw other stuff into the fermenting tank to make it appealing. We need hops, we need spices. And in his brewery, apparently raisins and grapes and all sorts of other stuff too, to make it of high enough quality to be able to compete with wine, perhaps?
Sam, sounds like fighting words. But wait, before you respond, I want to talk about this project that you two started that brought you together to sample sort of both beer and wine at what you called competitive dinners.
Basically, it started with a hemp beer tasting that we were both expert panelists for. I don't know what gave us the pedigree to be in that position.
I don't remember that, Sam.
Maybe it's just my
short-term memory.
Yeah, she didn't inhale the hemp beers. But from there, we worked at my brewery on some sales and marketing projects that we were doing, and we started these series of dinners where the diners would literally vote in real time at every course, and we would pair a wine and a beer with every course. People really dig it, and we've been doing, I think we've done 30 of these, and I think wine is either up by one victory or it's completely tied around 15 to 15 with beer winning and wine winning.
Interesting.
I think I'm up one.
You think
okay.
You're up one.
Of course but, she does.
But Marnie, you acknowledge it's close anyway, if not neck and neck.
Right.
Well, one of the things your book does in really interesting ways is it recommends what foods go with what beers and what wines. And I have some of the wine and foods that you've recommended right here in front of me. Marnie, you recommend this Australian unoaked Chardonnay with a sharp cheddar cheese.
I think that there's a perception that cheese needs to go with big red wines, and I always like to show it with a brighter, lighter style. In this case, you have sharp cheddar, so you're going to have that salty twang that really kind of hangs in the mouth like you've struck a tuning fork, and the acidity that is such a dominant feature on the first sip of drinking wine. The two together neutralize each other and are better together than they are apart.
Well, I got to say, this unoaked Chardonnay is lovely. The cheddar is good. They go great together. Sam, I'm going to come to you. You're going to make the case that this Dogfish Head IPA that you brew also goes good with the sharp cheddar.
Basically, fatty foods, particularly cheeses like this, literally coat your tongue. Wine kind of just bounces off a coated tongue, whereas beer, because of its bubbles and its effervescent, acts as an exfoliant. It scrubs your palate and you can taste more.
Wow.
You can taste more.
Is that what is going on as I drink this beer? My tongue is being exfoliated? This is what you're telling me?
Among other things. It's stronger than an average beer, but it's also citrusy sort of grassy elements to the hops, which of course is the hops is what gives beer its bitterness, works really, really well with this cheese. So I'm sure you're enjoying that.
They're both great. And I think in the interest of journalistic objectivity, I'm not going to sort of cast a vote in this continuing debate. Well, let's skip to dessert. We have some dark chocolate here. Sam, let me start with you. You're recommending a Young's Luxury Double Chocolate Stout.
Chocolate's a type of barley, a roasted barley. And
okay, well, I'm going to try it. So this is a nice dark chocolate with this stout. Now, I'm not usually a stout drinker. This is like Guinness, right? I mean, this is...
Well, this is going to be a little bit stronger than Guinness and a little bit more alcohol content and strong roasty character. And that roastiness that comes from the dark grain and contributes the color to that beer is going to be the perfect foil for the sweetness of the chocolate.
I got to say, this is one of the most fun interviews I've done in a long time. I'm not a big stout person, but with the chocolate, it kind of takes the edginess of the stout away. But it's a nice combination. It really is. Now, Marnie, what do you recommend that I have with this dark chocolate?
I didn't want to go for the heavy, heavy traditional port, the fortified sweet dessert wine that people always think of with chocolate. I thought we'd do something a little bit further off the beaten track today and introduce you to one of my favorite red dessert wines. It's a sparkling dessert wine from northern Italy. It's called Brochetto d'Acqui, and it is low in alcohol. It's full of bubbles. It is light and effervescent, and it has a flavor that is...
It right here, and it's got a very kind of almost rosé. It's darker than rosé, but it's lighter than normal red wine, right?
It is a vivid kind of mauve color, and it gives this fragrance that always reminds me of wild strawberries and rose petals, maybe with a little bit of black pepper or white pepper. It has a little bit of spicy aromatic to it as well.
Yeah, this has got a nice, sweet sort of effervescent thing going. It's great. It's really nice. Yeah.
And it's kind of a beer-like wine because it's carbonated, right?
That's why it's so good, right, Sam? But seriously, along that lines, you two have this shtick down. But, I mean, I've got to believe that after dueling this way that you've come to appreciate each other's drinks.
I think that's absolutely true. I love the fact that beer is single serving, that I can come home at the end of a long day and open the fridge and open a bottle and not have to worry about what's going to happen to the other four glasses in that bottle after I've had my one.
And, Sam, what about your acceptance of wine as a drink of choice?
Oh, it's true. There are great moments when I reach for a wine, you know, like in the case of a grease fire, and I got to put out a fire. But no,
you fight dirty, Sam.
In all honesty, and Marnie knows this, if I go into a restaurant and they have the same boring lineup of the same five generic lagers, I will protest vote and I'll usually get a Pinot Noir from Oregon or a great red wine from Washington State because at least I know I'm supporting the hop growing sector of America by buying the wines from there and I actually really do enjoy them.
Marnie, I think that's what you call damning with faint praise. I don't know. I may be wrong.
You know, Sam, you're right. Sam definitely does play dirty. But you know what? I think at the end of the day, I think that Sam, with his Italian heritage, might have been drinking a little wine somewhere along the way there. And that really, in many ways, both of these products really do share quite a lot.
Well, let's end it there on that note of beverage unity. Thank you both so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us,
Anthony. We appreciate you having us out.
That's Sam Calagione and Marnie Old. They're the authors of He Said Beer, She Said Wine, Impassioned Food Pairings to Debate and Enjoy from Burgers to Brie and Beyond.